Ooh, you want to play psycho killer? Can I be the helpless victim?
Cross your eyes and scream, man. Scream for your life!
Welcome. I'm your scream queen, Jenica Olin. This is my 13th episode, and we're starting February off with a classic love story, Bride of Frankenstein. My theme for this month is Till Death Do Us Part, with some love stories worth dying for. If you're new here, each episode will have an intro, brief synopsis of the movie, an analysis of the film, and then I get into the true crime of it all. I'm a huge true crime fan, and I like to make connections between the true horrors that inspire our darkest imaginations. The truth is, the stuff on screen is way tamer than the true horrors that take place every day. Spoiler alert, I've made it my job to spoil the shit out of this movie. Today, I'll be covering the 1935 Universal Monster story, The Bride of Frankenstein. So we have director James Whale, and our writers are Mary Shelley, William Hurlbut, and John Balderston. Starring Boris Karloff as the iconic Frankenstein, and Elsa Lanchester as the breathtaking bride. Colin Clive is our Henry Frankenstein, the father of Frankenstein, the man behind the monster. And Ernest Thesiger plays our villain, Dr. Pretorius. Some quick trivia about this film. So Karloff argued that it was a mistake in the sequel to have the monster speak, that too much sympathy was built up for the monster, and that the use of musical scoring was intrusive. Frankenstein has been criticized for its lack of music by modern writers who failed to consider that in 1931, background music was considered an outmoded artifact of the silent era. Elsa Lanchester said that her spitting, hissing performance was inspired by swans in Regent's Park, London. She said, "They're really very nasty creatures," she said. That's my impression. Elsa Lanchester's shock hairdo was held in place by a wired horsehair cage. The body count for this movie was originally 21, but after some edits, this was trimmed to 10 after pressure from the censors that be. Several scenes were cut after censors' objections, referencing the scandalous sexual arrangements of the historical Mary Shelley, Percy Shelley, and Lord Byron were eliminated. Particularly the line of dialogue, "We are all three infidels, scoffers at all marriage ties, believing only in living freely and fully." Breen's office also objected to shots they considered too revealing of Elsa Lanchester's cleavage in the prologue. Let's set the scene with a synopsis of the movie.
How beautifully dramatic! The crudest, savage exhibition of nature at her worst without, and we three, we elegant three within. I should like to think that an irate Jehovah was pointing those arrows of lightning directly at my head, the unbowed head of George Gordon, Lord Byron, England's greatest sinner. But I cannot flatter myself to that extent. Possibly those thunders of our dear Shelley, heaven's applause for England's greatest poet.
What of my Mary?
She is an angel.
You think so?
It feels to Percy Shelley and Lord Byron that Henry Frankenstein and his monster did not die. Both lived and went on to even stranger misadventures than before. We flash back to scenes from Frankenstein, which lead us to the new story. After the mill collapses and it seems the monster has been destroyed, the Burgermeister urges everyone to return to their homes. But the father of the little girl whom the monster had killed in the first movie wants to see the creature's dead body with his own eyes before he can have peace. His wife tries to stop him, but when the man wanders through the still burning debris, he falls through a hole that leads to a flooded cavern below the mill. The monster rises out of the water and kills the poor man, later doing the same for his wife.
Give me your hand, Hans.
The Frankenstein's hysterical servant, Minnie, also meets with the monster, but manages to escape with her life. But no one believes her when she screeches that the monster is still on the loose. Henry wants nothing more than to settle into a peaceful life with his new bride. But his old professor, the sinister Dr. Pretorius, now disgraced, appears unexpectedly and convinces him to continue his work of creating new life. Pretorius has been conducting his own experiments, but can do no better than to create people who are a few inches tall. Soon the village learns that the monster is still alive. They capture him, but the powerful creature escapes his prison and goes wandering through the forest as the villagers hunt him.
He's loose! Shoot him!
The monster discovers an isolated cabin occupied by an old blind hermit who is playing the violin. The creature and the lonely hermit soon become friends as the old man teaches the monster the joy of music, cigars, bread, and wine. The monster understands human speech and soon learns to speak himself. They both finally found happiness.
And now for our lesson. Remember, this is bread. Bread.
Bread.
And this is wine. To drink.
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 Which is dashed when two travelers stop by to ask for direction. They recognize the monster and attack him, inadvertently burning down the hermit's cabin in the battle.
What are you doing? This is my friend.
Friend? This is the fiend that's been murdering half the countryside. Good heavens, man, can't you see?
The monster runs away, miserable once again. A chance meeting in a tomb brings Dr. Pretorius and the monster together. And Pretorius uses the monster to kidnap Miss Frankenstein and blackmail Henry into returning to his castle and continuing his experiments. The monster wants his creature to build him a friend. And Pretorius wants to see dead tissue become a living woman. Henry is forced to give his creature a bride. Henry and Pretorius succeed in following the creation of man with the creation of woman. But woman is not happy with man and backs away from him, hissing in horror and fear.
Man? Friend?
The monster is despondent. He frees Henry and his wife and then releases a lever that blows the castle to atoms.
She hates me.
Presumably, destroying himself, his bride, and Dr. Pretorius. Now it's time to talk horror, and today my guest is Elizabeth Davis. By the way, I love your name.
Oh, thank you.
So Elizabeth is my middle name.
Okay.
And it comes from my family on, like, my dad's side. And then Eleanor was my grandma's, like, her best friend. Oh, and they, like, did everything together.
Wonderful. So, my middle name is Eleanor, and my grandmother's name was Eleanor.
You and your husband both run the golf night once a month at Conduit called Void Terror Silence. And that's always a lot of fun. You guys do a great job, especially with all your skeletons.
Yeah, to make it atmospheric.
Yeah, you guys do very Frankenstein.
Yeah, we like to lean into a little bit of the camp that used to come along with goth tradition because it's not always around so much anymore.
Yeah, no, and the reason why I thought of you for this episode is because you guys did such a phenomenal job with the Frankenstein theme, and just, you guys were so creative, like, all the display that you had on that table with all the, I don't know, like, science equipment.
Yeah, yeah.
And and you guys made it all yourself?
We made all of that. So basically the moment that Jeff and I knew we wanted to start DJing, before the first gig started, mm-hmm. I said, I want to do a Halloween party at some point. Like, I just, that was just one of the big goals I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So it took us about 2 years, but we finally got the opportunity and the space, the wonderful space, the Conduit. And so we had some of the pieces that we had built. We do a home haunt every year for the neighborhood kids.
I love that.
Yeah, it's a lot, so much fun. But yeah, we didn't have anything specifically bespoke Frankenstein, but because that it's so atmospheric and it conjures up such, like, a specific vision, there was so much to go on and so much we could kind of build.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we ended up building, like, we had the lab table, we had, like, the beakers and all that, and then we built this big box that kind of, like, looked like it had sparks. And
I remember that it was very impressive. You guys, everything you guys put together was very impressive. And then when I found out you were, like, an artist, and it just made more sense. Like, oh yeah, of course. Yeah. She was able to put that together because she's an artist.
Like, yeah. So by artist by day, DJ by moonlight.
So today we're here to talk about Bride of Frankenstein. Is there anything that you want to plug while I have you here?
Oh, okay. Well, of course, for anyone who's local to Central Florida, we do VTS, which is Void Terror Silence. That's monthly. The date can kind of change, but it's usually towards the end of the month. We also do some other DJing around town, various events. I'm under the name Void 407, and my husband is DJ Jeffrey Skull. And then I'm a visual artist, so I have a website, Black Abbey Studios. I sell original paintings and prints, and I would describe it kind of as, like, dark but whimsical fantasy art. So you can find me online there and on all the socials too.
Awesome. Yes. You guys should definitely check her out if you're listening. Her paintings are beautiful. And I saw you just did another DJ event for, like, a jazz. You did jazz?
Yeah. So one of our DJ teams is called Crux. It's run by a very talented DJ, Adramada Audrey. And it started kind of off as a joke that, like, the goth kids were going to have, like, one random night where we just spin jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that last year, and it was so much fun. And we learned so much that we decided to just do it again this year. And it was even maybe arguably more fun this time. So.
Nice.
I think maybe
I love that.
Like, an animal tradition that goths spin jazz once a year.
Yeah. No, I love that. That's great. All right. So getting into the whole mythos of, like, Bride of Frankenstein and Frankenstein as a whole. I mean, there's the general theme of, like, man creating life. Men creating life.
Yeah.
With other men. And they don't need women or God or anyone. Like, they need more control than they already have. Hey, I'm just joking. I mean, not really. I almost see, like, as I was doing this, I mean, I put in like little political tidbits in here just because it's part of my humor.
Yeah, sure.
So I was looking through it and I was kind of like, Melania Trump is almost like Bride of Frankenstein. She's our modern Bride of Frankenstein. I feel like she hates him.
Yeah. But yeah, and she's just like, I did not consent to any of this.
Yeah. Like she was made for him, but I'm sure he bought her. And, you know, she is kind of stuck in this relationship and she really doesn't want to be there. I don't think. She definitely wears like, have you seen, she wears like hats so she can't kiss him.
What is with the weirdo hat? And it's like, it's not like an unstylish outfit, but it's just a weird, it's like, that's a choice. That's weird. Hats and doors, cover your eye. And then when he went in to give her a kiss, oh, this lady is smarter than we think she is.
Yeah, I really think she's our modern Bride of Frankenstein in some ways.
Maybe, yeah. Definitely in a place you don't want to be and didn't ask to be there.
So Bride of Frankenstein, she only shows up for like 5 minutes in the entire film.
Yeah.
But the whole thing is like building up to this, you know, this creature that's going to be created for Frankenstein. And I really felt bad for Frankenstein. Like you feel bad for him in the first movie. You can have sympathy for him. But you really like the fact that he talks in this one, and he smiles, and he makes friends,
right?
Like they make him so personable.
I think that's one of the things. One of the things I have always gravitated towards the whole story is, you know, we talked about this a little bit before we got going on the air, but like I was a very fearful child, and so I was really scared of monsters as a kid, and there was something I was in a. Of course, I was terrified of Frankenstein, but there was something kind of vulnerable about him, and you could kind of tell there was a little bit more than meets the eye. And then reading the novels and watching the movies, you know, he just kind of he's just a victim of his poor circumstances in a lot of ways, and then he kind of chooses to be monstrous.
Yeah.
But as anybody who grew up feeling a little bit like an outsider, I think it's very easy to have empathy for the monster.
Yeah. I think as someone who, like, I was in education for a long time in like early childhood education. And then eventually I got into elementary ed. But I saw him, I see him as like a little, like a 3-year-old throwing a temper tantrum.
Yeah. Right.
He's just doesn't know how to express himself. He's really angry. He's been put in this world that, you know, no one's accepting of him, and it's kind of sad for him,
right? Like pretty much from the moment it's alive, like no one shows him really hardly any kindness, and then he just gets a couple of brief respites of it throughout the story.
Yeah,
but and then is just treated like a monster.
Yeah, even his creator, like he's rejected by his creator. So that's, I know that there is a lot of connection between the gay themes. James Whale, he was gay.
I just recently learned that not only was he gay, but I guess he was living an openly gay lifestyle, which back in the 30s would have been pretty brave. The themes of feeling like an outsider.
Exactly.
People treating you with less empathy.
Yeah. And even like your creator rejecting you. So many families rejected their children and still do, unfortunately, reject their children for being gay. And it's horrible that we're having to deal with that issue again. We're reverting in a lot of ways when it comes to gay rights and trans rights and all these things. And Frankenstein is actually a very political movie. It's just as relevant now as it was in the 1930s.
Yeah, and then even going back further to elements of the novel when Mary Shelley wrote it, and I don't know, like I would have to definitely fact check me on this, but if my literature classes remind me, I think her mother, I think she was a feminist at the time and did a lot of feminist writings and feminist teachings. So I think that's one of the things that gave Mary Shelley like the courage and the vocabulary to write such a great novel. So it's always kind of been, I guess, counterculture from the jump.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, she was definitely, she's mentioned as being a feminist. And that's not something that you see very often with figures from the past.
There are female writers, but they're few and far between, especially during that age.
Yeah, and for her to get the recognition that she did, I mean, she must have gone through hell.
Right. Well, yeah. And then created basically the first science fiction, really, out of it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mary Shelley, wherever she is. I think so. In my research, I was found that a psychiatrist had selected 44 simple words for the monster's vocabulary. And they literally used like a 10-year-old's homework, a 10-year-old kid that was working on the set, that kid's homework.
Oh, wow.
For his vocabulary.
Crazy. I love the scene in when he's sitting down with the blind man and he's learning, you know, smoke and drink food.
Yeah.
And you can see him like it's heartwarming because it's like the very first time we get to see him like actually enjoying himself briefly. He's like smiling, or when the old man puts him to bed and he actually kind of has a tear coming down his face. It's like, oh, buddy.
It's like the first person that shows care or concern or anything for him. And like because the guy's blind, when he's touching him, he says, you're injured or you're hurt or something. I can't remember the exact words that he used, but he shows concern for him. And I just find it really interesting that the one person that shows him any kind of kindness is the hermit out in the woods in some shack. And he's a blind man, putting more emphasis on the outsiders or outcasts of society.
And, right.
You know, that whole theme.
And hammering home the don't judge a book by its cover, because he's enjoying his company otherwise.
Yeah. Until the villagers happened to come across the cabin, they would have lived a very happy life out there.
Probably.
But then they come in and they make him upset. They, you know, and Frankenstein has a really bad temper. He accidentally, you know, burns up the cabin, which I felt bad for him then too, because he didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that whole scene?
The fact that they wouldn't even listen to what the blind man had to say about it. You know, it's like he comes bursting into this dude's house and he says, no, you know, don't hurt my friend, get out of here. And then they just decide to start a fight anyway. And then they burn a poor blind man's house down.
Yeah, it is their fault. It is not Frankenstein's fault. So many of the casualties are accidental.
It's interesting because you can tell part of it is like a monster who is just trying to make sense of the world. Everyone's being very unkind to him. He barely has a moment to kind of like come into consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so everything's just a primal reaction. Now we do see in a few instances where he is like making the decision to commit violence.
Yes.
And then that brings up another, like, if you really deep dive into the concepts of that go back to the novel is, you know, nature versus nurture. And is he just a product of his environment, or is he also trying, he's making choices to be violent. So it's a little bit of both by the end of the second film.
Yeah, especially the final scene, which I don't want to get too much into yet, but he definitely makes a conscious decision to pull the lever. Mm-hmm. And he's even very specific about who deserves to live and who deserves to die.
Yeah, which is kind of all of a sudden he's like, you know, he's going to let Henry in this version, Henry Frankenstein, leave. Like, I would think like the Dr. Frankenstein would be on the hit list, but maybe it's because his wife comes in and knocks on the door and is frantically looking for him. And she's kind of a true innocent on all of this. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's why the monster decides, okay, you and your wife go, we're going to stay here and pull the lever.
Yeah.
But it was weird. It's like, you're right. Like the doctor from moment one, he's responsible for all of this and then does not take any accountability for his actions.
Yeah. Oh, one other thing about the bride. Elizabeth is Henry's bride. Mm-hmm. We have basically two brides of Frankenstein.
Yes, because technically,
which I thought was very funny. It's like, who are you referring to in the title, Bride of Frankenstein? Is it Elizabeth the bride or is it the monster's bride?
Yeah, maybe that's what contributed also to us calling the monster Frankenstein, which even I do. I mean, I know he's the monster. The Frankenstein is the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But between the first film being called Frankenstein and the second film, Bride of Frankenstein, where clearly they're trying to make the monster a mate, it just got cemented in the public consciousness that the monster is Frankenstein.
He was created by Henry Frankenstein, and his last name is Frankenstein, so you would assume it would pass down to him, like as if he was the child.
Yeah.
So he's like Frankenstein Jr. My comment is that I love that we have a gay director with a cast of blasphemous people that don't seem to be religious, and a feminist writer.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why horror is such an important genre in film, is what I said. Like the fact that we're able to get this all in one place, like where else would you find that except for in horror?
Yeah. I'm learning a little bit more and more that like horror is never really necessarily about horror. It's always about society on some level, in some way.
Yeah. And that's what a lot of what I do in my podcast is connect the backstory of the horror to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, like a lot of the scary parts of horror, like it kind of melts away for me whenever I'm able to put a context to it. I think anytime you're able to learn more about something, you're able to kind of peel or whatever the top layer, and it's less intimidating.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, that's true. There's also a fair amount of humor in this one as well, which I think also kind of diffuses some of the more, horrific aspects of it. It's downright funny in places.
Oh, yeah. It's really funny. When he's smoking that cigar, he's hilarious. he's like, good, good. And he's like smiling with the cigar in his lip and just like puffing the smoke.
Mm-hmm.
It's really comical.
Yeah, it's funny too, because when I told Jeff Avion, he was like, don't get too confused with Young Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. And I thought, well, no, I'll keep, they're very different. And then when I watched that scene, I was like, Mel Brooks was still very genius with what he did with that film. But some of it's like, he didn't have to go very far. Like some of the humor was just amped up just a little bit. It's still pretty funny.
Yeah.
And the maid is very funny.
Yes. Oh my God. I have so many quotes from her. She's probably one of my favorite characters. Minnie. She says, I think my favorite quote from her is in the beginning. She goes, she sees Frankenstein. She's able to get away from him.
Mm-hmm.
And she tells everyone, he's alive. He's alive. No one listens to her. And her quote is so iconic. She says, nobody believe me. All right. I wash my hands of it. They can all be murdered in their beds.
And they look on her face, she's like, me.
Mm-hmm. She knows everyone's business. She knows what's going on. And she's ignored, kind of like the town drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Except she's kind of seen as, but she's not a drunk in the movie. She's just seen as like the crazy maiden that is going to go and talk some shit. And she does. She talks a lot of shit. She's very insightful, but no one wants to hear her.
Yeah, it's almost just like, oh, it's Minnie. She's just always out at 11. And she's like, yeah, but she saw the monster walk out of the window. Okay.
Whenever Elizabeth is in her room, like powdering up, and Minnie is leaving, and she's like, do you want me to stay? I don't feel comfortable leaving you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then she's like, no, I'll be fine. And of course she gets kidnapped. But Minnie had the right instincts. She knew she was worldly, I would say.
We should have just let Minnie handle the whole thing.
She would have taken care of all of it. The music in Bride of Frankenstein. So like the first Frankenstein movie doesn't have music.
I just learned that recently too, after I did a rewatch of this one. Yeah, I watched the regular Frankenstein this past Halloween. And first I thought like there was something wrong with the app I was watching it on, because I was like, is it really no music? But yeah, it's not. Mm-hmm. And so there is in this one, and it's good music, but it often like lighthearted in weird moments, which is also really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it just adds like another layer to it. I guess the other thing just in general too to be said about it is it's very well paced.
Yeah.
So, and I think maybe the music helps with that. I think
mm-hmm.
comparing the two films, they're both good, but in my opinion, I think Bride of Frankenstein might be the better movie because it flows along better and it's paced better. And I think maybe the music
and has a lot to do with that. Yeah. The original Frankenstein was criticized because of the lack of music, but it also was coming off of the era in which silent films was the thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you think about it that way, because what, like, Frankenstein was 31.
Yeah.
And then Bride was 35.
Yeah.
35. So, yeah, a lot would have happened in just that short time.
Yeah, no, exactly. What I was able to find about the music is the Franz Waxman score of Bride is like a classic example of music being as important as the visuals for setting the tone of a fantasy. The picture looks and sounds much like an opera.
Yeah. Okay.
And then you've got visuals that are very, it's black and white, right? So, but there's still a glow to it.
Yeah. There's even like certain stills from it or certain just shots that almost still feel very like German art house expressionism, like especially when there's two doctors in this one. Mm-hmm. And when they're messing with the machinery at the end, like they're the very striking black and white images, like as they're pulling levers and hitting buttons, is super atmospheric. Yeah.
So the little people, I was trying to find out what they all were. So there was a queen, mm-hmm. a king, a bishop, a ballet dancer, a baby.
I forgot about the baby.
There was a baby.
And a mermaid, right?
There was a mermaid and there was a devil who resembled Pretorius. Okay, I have a note in here. They were photographed separately in large scale jars and then matted into the small jar.
Okay.
However that gets done.
So, some kind of composite where you're putting one piece of film up with another. And
So I saw this as like, this was building it up to Pretorius is like a mad scientist mm-hmm. on a whole other spectrum.
I guess. And that would make sense, right? Because we have in the first film, right, we have Henry Frankenstein, who's obsessed mm-hmm. and then realizes really quickly he flew too close to the sun, like the mm-hmm. mom for Prometheus, right? And he's avowed himself to not do this ever again.
Yeah.
So for a sequel, you always kind of have to up the ante, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to bring in a bigger matter scientist. And Dr. Pretorius, I guess, definitely fits that role.
Yeah.
He's creepy. He's downright creepy.
He is. He's very creepy. And he's a straight up villain. He's the villain of the movie. Like the fact that he has Elizabeth kidnapped, he's using blackmail. Right. To get Henry to help him.
And he's manipulating the monster, really.
Yeah.
He doesn't really care about the monster's feelings. He's just using him.
But even Frankenstein, even the monster Frankenstein sees through everything that Pretorius is doing. And so at that ending scene, he keeps them with them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he's at least observant enough.
The other thing I found, kind of striking about Dr. Pretorius was his transatlantic accent was like so thick. First of all, like it's thick in a lot of the characters in the movie. Mm-hmm. I've kind of forgotten that this was like a fake accent that we made for early movies, but his is so pronounced and so mm-hmm. thick that it's just like trilling the R's and whatnot, and it just kind of adds to just how extra creepy he is.
I will say that Pretorius had some of the best lines in the movie, too.
Yeah, I think so. Of course, nothing specifically to just what his delivery is what I just remembered the most and just how mm-hmm. like how incredibly creepy it was.
Yeah, he's so impassioned.
Yeah, and so he's in so how he finds the monster. The monster is trying to escape another mob. He crawls into a crypt, right, mm-hmm. to just like catch his breath. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Pretorius is there with two grave robbers looking for, parts to build this person. And then they're done for the night. They're like, we're clocking out, boss. Okay. And you need any help out of here. And he's like, nah, I'm just going to hang here. Cause I like it. And it's just like, okay, that's like the first taste we get about like just how creepy and evil, I guess he's supposed to be, like rather mm-hmm. sit here with the corpses and the bones, drinking his brain.
Yeah, he's super morbid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as a goth, I can't really like call the kettle black too much. I hang out in graveyards, so.
I remember taking pictures in graveyards mm-hmm. and with our like Polaroid cameras, and So there was a subplot that got edited out because they had to cut the movie down. So Carl, he imitates the monster's murderous mode and operandi to eliminate his aunt. It says miserly aunt, but I don't speak like this. So it's very weird how it's like written out. He wanted to basically kill his aunt and uncle and direct the blame away from himself by making it look like it was the monster. Mm-hmm. So there was this whole subplot of the monster being framed for murder, but they ended up cutting it out.
Okay. Oh. I did not know that.
I thought that was cool. I was like, yeah, that makes sense. I can see a lot of people taking this as an opportunity to just like kill off people they don't care about.
Yeah.
Or they hate.
Yeah.
Or,
right. Well, in the novel, I think too, there's a mistaken identity, but I think it's the opposite. Like it was the monster that may have been responsible, but it's like the maid who bears the brunt of the crime or something like that. It's a little fuzzy. It's been a while since I've read it.
I wanted to talk about some of the religious imagery really quick. Mm-hmm. The captured monster raised aloft on a pole, and he's pelted by rocks. And this is like symbolic of the crucifixion.
Mm.
And then there's also a crucifix in the hermit's cabin is heavily emphasized. And the monster angrily topples a statue of a bishop. And Pretorius, he implicitly quotes biblical phrases. He says, male and female created he them, be fruitful and multiply.
Mm.
So he's trying to play God.
Right. Very angry, kind of.
Yeah. There's a lot of reference to God and man creating man. And the production, like the final cost of this movie was $397,000. Which was about $100,000 over their budget. They had one over. But my question for you, I don't know if you know inflation from 1935 to now, but my question is $397,000 in 1935, how much do you think that is in today's money?
I wish I had a number for you. I have no clue. I guess if I throw a dart, I don't know.
Do you think it's over 5 million or under 5 million?
See, my inclination would be to say under 5 million, but I have a feeling you're going to tell me that's wrong.
You have a 50-50 chance here. So you're going with over?
I don't know. I don't want to say so. I don't know. Under. I'll go under.
Under. Okay. Well, it was over.
I did take the hint.
It was nine. It's close to 9 million in today's money, which actually is kind of a lower budget for a movie. By today's standards. Yeah. Most movies are like $20 million.
Mm-hmm.
So they did it on a pretty low budget.
Yeah. The other thing I found interesting, it's funny how far movies have come in general. It's just like, the credits in the beginning and they show them at the end. And there's like even a little caveat at the end. It's like, it's a cast so good. It's worth like highlighting twice. But it's just like, mm-hmm. I don't know, there's 15 people who worked on this movie. It's like one title card, two title cards. That's it.
Ta-da. Yeah.
It's like, that's not how it is these days. It's like,
everyone gets credit.
Yeah.
Everyone gets credit now. Before it was so many people weren't even mentioned in the credits. For The Bride and the woman who plays Mary Shelley, she was actually, I was reading that in the credits, she was just put as like a question mark.
Yes, she is. But she does get credit for playing Mary Shelley. And then the monster is like, ooh, we don't know who this could possibly be. It's like, I will never forget those eyebrows. That's her.
No, she's iconic.
To The Bride, though, that is, it was an interesting choice. It was cool because we don't get that in the first movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it opens with Mary Shelley, Lord Byron, and Percy Shelley sitting by the fire,
mm-hmm.
and they're kind of teasing her about her ability to have written this novel as a woman.
Yeah.
Which is interesting and maybe doesn't hold up by today's standards, but in another way, it's interesting and progressive that they even gave that credit back then and thought to put that in the movie in the first place, that this was written by the delicate fingers of this lady, right?
Yeah, no, it was progressive. I almost felt like it was commentary instead of believing that she couldn't do it.
Right, right. But then to see her kind of bookended at the end of the movie, that it's like, oh, you know, it was her, you know, it's her all along, you know, like it's,
yeah,
it's interesting. It's fun.
I've kind of been skirting around the whole, like, Frankenstein kills them when he pulls the lever. But I just found that that scene, because they're all kind of outcasts to society. We've got the mad scientist, we've got the monster, and we've got the monster's bride. And they all kind of, they're seen as they don't belong. So he's eliminating himself, which is sad.
It is sad, but I could see where he would get there. You know, humanity has not been kind to him. It's been proven to him throughout both movies that he'll never quite be accepted. Mm-hmm. Then he is finally given his heart's desire, which is the mate. She gets 5 minutes before he just declares that, oh, she hates me. It's like, oh, let her warm up to the idea. But but he realized, I guess, he think he realizes really quickly, like, this world is never going to be for me. I was never supposed to be here in the first place.
Yeah,
it is incredibly sad.
Yeah.
But also, I guess, very, very operatic, very dramatic for an ending.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
And to take the doctor out with him to ensure it's never going to happen again.
Yes. I didn't think of it as that. I thought of it as, but I see that connection. Yeah. Because he's the one who kept escalating things in that direction when Henry Frankenstein didn't want to continue. He saw what he had done and he regret playing with a human life.
Yeah, maybe that's part of the reason he gets to wiggle away at the end, because I don't know.
Yeah.
Because he came to repent that he messed with it in the first place. And it's funny because I guess it does happen again. It's got to happen again, right? Because there's a son of Frankenstein. Now, I've never seen that one.
I haven't seen it either. Spoiler alert. He does. Frankenstein survives. They don't show the bride again.
I don't believe so. Because I think I liked this movie so much that if I knew she was in other movies, I would have watched those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm glad that they didn't have her say anything. I'm glad that they just had her looking at him and screaming. And she has this shriek that she does that's just, it's very guttural. You can tell she's, like, terrified of him.
Yeah. Like again, we talked about she's only in the movie, or at least for, like, just a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But what she does with those few minutes is just, without saying a word, it's got such an impact, and it's so, like, off-putting and uncanny. She, like, kind of, like, hisses as a cat.
Mm-hmm.
She snaps her head back and forth almost like a bird. It's very, it's very unnatural, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess kind of echoes back to the whole concept of we shouldn't have been here. You know, no one's meant to play God, or science is not meant to replace God, or whatever it is. Impacted by just how unnatural and creepy she is.
Yeah.
Which is also in contrast too, because she's pretty to look at. Yeah. She's very pretty.
She is.
But then she's really freaky.
Yeah. So I found some information saying, like, the double casting was designed to make a further statement on the bride's authority, which I found really interesting.
Interesting. Okay.
So, according to feminist theorist Elizabeth Young, in her view, Mary's opening words are forming the story that gives a voice to the bride's scream, which is the most visceral and impassioned version of Mary's story. Young concludes that the power of their voices combined will offer a rejection of the systems that would dismember, disembody, exchange, and erase them.
Okay. Wow. Well, first of all, visceral, I think, is a great word to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly. But yeah, I don't know that I have too much to add to that. That's pretty well put.
Her analysis of it was pretty on point, and I think it is a rejection of the systems that are in place. Okay, so I have a little segment. It's called Whose Line Is It? And it's not going to be too hard, but I'm going to give you, like, four different lines, and you can tell me if it's Pretorius, the monster, Henry, or Minnie. Because I loved Minnie's lines so much, I had to put some of her lines. So the first line, we belong dead. Who said that?
Well, that's going to be the monster, right? Because that's how we kind of close the film.
Yes, yeah. Ding, ding, ding. Yes, you're right. That was the monster, and that is what he said before pulling the lever. So the next one, sometimes I think I would be better if we were all devils. Wait, I said that wrong. Sometimes I think it would be better if we were all devils with no nonsense about angels and being good.
Oh, that's a tough one because I think that could be possibly attributed to either of the doctors. But based on the hints we talked about earlier with the Bible stories, I'm going to go with Pretorius.
Yes, yeah. It was Pretorius. And Pretorius is definitely the most evil of them. That would be like, we don't need the idea of angels. We are good versus bad. Like, just get rid of that. We should just all be devils. Mm. It's so him. And actually, I read that a lot of his lines were not, he kind of went off script. Oh. And he came up with a lot of that on his own. So he was just already this like evil man, kind of. I don't know. I'd hate to find him under my bed at night. He's a nightmare in the daylight. He is.
Well, that's Minnie because that line struck me like a nightmare in the daylight. I thought that was just a really cool, a well-written line. I've known people like that too. I've known nightmares in the daylight.
Yeah.
I'm putting that one in my pocket. I'm going to use that one later.
So the last line I'm going to say is, but this isn't science. It's more like black magic.
Oh.
Who said that? So that could have been Pretorius or Henry Frankenstein.
I think it was Henry when he's showing the little people, right?
Yes.
Because there are very different sciences. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, you said something interesting earlier about the music making it kind of like an opera. And, mm-hmm. you know, obviously, this is a movie from 1935 where special effects and sound stages and everything has come so far. So there are times, especially when, like, Dracula's in the graveyard, or you're seeing like long shots of the castle. Mm-hmm. You can tell it's a miniature. You can tell it's a painted curtain, right? You can tell it's a soundstage.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something that charming about that, very charming, that I've only been to a couple of operas, but one of the ones I went to was like a big one with massive sets and curtains and backdrops. And so it is, yeah, it like added, even though it looks very faux, something mm-hmm. about it adds a lot to the drama and the atmosphere of it. And like that coupled with the lighting and the music really make an impact in the film.
Yeah, I think it's the fantasy aspect of it because it's not supposed to be real life. It's supposed to be commentary on issues that we deal with in life. You know, people who feel like outsiders, it's, you know, about them wanting to be accepted.
Yeah, I think Frankenstein stands out in that way. It's very different from other, we think of the icons of like classic horror. He stands out among the other monsters because, you know, it was never really his intention, initial intention, to be violent or to be a monster.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a softer side to him. And it's kind of what, you know, it goes back and forth. Frankenstein's always been a tale of who is the real monster.
Mm-hmm.
Is it us or is it him?
It's us.
Yeah.
We are the monsters. Guillermo del Toro is working on a Frankenstein movie, and it's just going to be called Frankenstein. It's going to have Mia Goth in it, which I love Mia Goth. She has become like a horror movie icon, like Scream Queen.
Okay.
So she is definitely a powerhouse. And then there are some other like really good names in here, but.
Isaac has a role in it?
Yes, he does.
He plays, but.
Yeah, and then Ralph Ineson, Christopher Waltz. This is going to be a good movie.
Yeah.
There's another one coming out this year. The Bride is a 2025, so it's coming out this year, and it's a modern take on the classic Bride of Frankenstein. It's written, directed, and produced by Maggie Gyllenhaal. Which I like Maggie Gyllenhaal. It stars Christian Bale as Frankenstein's monster, and then Jesse Beckley as the bride, and Penelope Cruz is also going to be in it, which I haven't seen Penelope Cruz in a hot minute. I'll tell you a little bit about the plot of this one because it seems a little weird, but it's like one of those things where, you know, when you're dealing with a classic, like Bride of Frankenstein and Frankenstein, a lot of people are going to come in with concept of what it should look like. So when I was seeing like these stills or like little bits of the filming, just didn't feel like Bride. It didn't feel like her.
I haven't seen anything about it whatsoever. I've been following a little bit of the Del Toro, like just when there's an update. But is it going to be taking place in like, is it a period piece?
So yeah, it's going to be 1930 Chicago. Frankenstein asks a doctor to create a companion for him. Okay, the two create a life for a murdered woman. So someone was murdered, they're bringing her back to life. She's his bride, and it sparks romance, police interest, and social change. So Frankenstein's always going to be about social change, but I guess the whole thing that I don't like is that she actually is romance, like there's actually a romance in it.
Oh, okay.
They're zombies, you know?
I don't know.
I just wish they would leave out the, could she just hate him? Could we continue with the hate? I'm going to call 2025 the year of Frankenstein.
Yeah, maybe.
Frankenstein's comeback. Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I know I've kept you for a while now. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks so much. Not much of a public speaker, but this was easy. Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. No, I'm cheers to Gods and Monsters.
The Bride of Frankenstein.
Now it's time for the true horrors. Mary Shelley took inspiration for her classic monster Frankenstein from real events that took place. I already covered the science that inspired the creation of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein in my episode on Reanimator, which is a parody of Frankenstein. For this episode, I will briefly go over those events. Among the influences, she cites a preface to an 1831 edition of her novel is Galvani, who in 1780 found that an electrical charge would make a dead frog's legs twitch. It was Percy who may have acquainted her with galvanism, which Frankenstein explicitly mentions as the key to reanimation in the 1831 edition. As a boy, the poet had dabbled with electricity. Scientists like Luigi Galvani and Giovanni Aldini were conducting public experiments on electricity and its effects on the dead body, which would have been widely known during Shelley's time. Scientific debates about the nature of life and the life principle were prevalent, which could have contributed to Shelley's exploration of the ethical implications of creating life artificially. For this episode, I want to focus on the tragedy that befell the cast and crew of this classic tale. As I was doing my research, I came across more than a few unfortunate events that occurred on set or in cast members' personal lives. This will include the conditions in which Karloff and Elsa Lanchester were subjected to. Karloff had reservations about reprising his most famous role. He rarely complained about the physical ordeals the parts demanded, but in a 1958 radio interview with Clive Edwards in Carmel, California, he recalls the vigor of making the first film.
"The makeup took about 4 hours to put on. I worked every day on the film. The film took 8 weeks to make, and I remember one awful occasion when I got into the makeup shop at 3:30 in the morning to be ready to go out on location. We worked in the hot sun at the edge of the lake, the scene with a little girl. We came back to the studio in the evening to have some supper, and we went out onto the back lot, and I worked all night until 5 in the morning. I had the makeup on for 25 hours. That was a long pull. The carbon lights were dreadful. They hurt my eyes. The boots weighed about 16 pounds apiece. All told, the outfit weighed between 40
and 45 pounds. Acting in the costume further damaged Karloff's back, which he had injured years before as a laborer loading cement for Eastman Building Supply in Hollywood. Karloff reported for work at 4 a.m., fortified by continual rounds of tea and cigarettes. The makeup took about 4 hours to apply each morning, and he was padded up and out 7 feet and 6 inches, with at least 50 pounds of suit and heavy weighted shoe. The long hours and grueling work conditions led directly to his becoming one of the founding members of the Screen Actors Guild. When filming the scene where the monster emerges from the burnt windmill, Boris Karloff slipped and fell into the water-filled well. Upon being helped out, it was discovered that he had dislocated a hip in the fall. The hip was strapped into place and Karloff soldiered on. He continued to receive massages and heat treatments for the hip for the rest of the shooting of the film. Boris Karloff sweated off 20 pounds laboring in the hot costume and makeup. According to Elsa Lanchester, her bride makeup took 3 hours and Boris Karloff's took 5. According to Elsa Lanchester, her bride makeup took 3 hours and Boris Karloff's took 5. For her role as the bride, she is 5'4" naturally. Elsa Lanchester was placed on stilts that made her 7 feet tall. The bandages were so tight that she was unable to move. She had to be carried around the studio and fed through a straw. Elsa Lanchester had to spend days trussed up tightly in bandages. She needed to be fed by her dresser, since even her fingers were wrapped. According to one story, one of her stand-ins had a screaming attack of claustrophobia. Colin Clive, the perfect Henry Frankenstein, is supposed to be in feeble health in the sequel, and is therefore less dynamic than before, yet his nervous tension is shattering and overtones of tragedy hover around him. It wasn't at all make-believe. Clive was an ill and desperately unhappy man, afflicted with acute alcoholism, which led to his death at the age of 37. Not long before filming began, Colin Clive broke a leg in a horse riding accident. Consequently, most of Henry Frankenstein's scenes are shot with him sitting. Colin Clive's alcoholism had worsened since the first film, but James Whale did not recast the role because his hysterical quality was necessary for the film. So, I have some other unfortunate events that happened to cast members that are not the main characters. Elizabeth was played by brunette Valerie Hobson, who replaced blonde Mae Clark from the original Frankenstein due to illness. Frederick Kerr played Henry's father, Baron Frankenstein, in Frankenstein, 1931. He died in 1933, so the role was written out rather than recast. According to Elsa Lanchester, Will seemed to be jealous of all the attention Karloff got and referred to him as the truck driver. Many publicity photos show the normally aloof Will hamming it up on set, upstaging his star. Then we've got our cinematographer, John Meskel's drinking had become so problematic that the studio had to provide a car to get him safely to and from the set. James Whale liked that he worked fast and rarely wasted time fussing with incidental camera and lighting hardware. He was still very good at his job, even when drunk. And with those tidbits of tragedy, let's end on a high note.
Friend?
Getting deeper into the horror underground as I make connections with people in the indie horror department. I've watched some indie horror movies that have not been released yet, and I will have some interviews coming your way. I will call these segments Indie Horror Highlights. If you would like to reach me, you can email me at screamqueenpodcaster@gmail.com. I also have an Instagram under screamqueenpodcaster, A Blue Sky under Scream Queen Podcast, and you can find me on Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok as well. I have a link tree to help with the navigation process. I'm most active on Blue Sky and Instagram. Some horror-related events happening near me. I'm looking forward to MegaCon coming to Orlando February 6th through the 9th. So that is next week for me from where I am right now. I have a four-day pass, and I'm looking forward to cosplaying and meeting people in the horror scene. I will be attending the Indie Horror Junkie Film Festival that's happening Friday through Sunday. Indie horror movies Screamboat, The Inn, and Mutilator 2 will be screening, and there will be a Q&A section afterwards with a panel of producers and cast members. I look forward to asking some questions. I started last episode, and I'm going to continue with this little tradition where I shout out people who leave five-star reviews. I might even mention some comments on social media, depending on what they are. When it comes to like the comment section that I'm finding, really the platforms that I can find the comments on are, it would be either YouTube, Apple Podcast, the Amazon streaming, or Spotify. Those are the ones that I have like access to in that way. The rest of the platforms people get my podcast from, I have like a host website that distributes my podcast. So I don't have access to all platforms myself. On Apple Podcast, Grim Thrall Podcast, actually, so this is someone with their own podcast. They wrote, they said, the podcast is a wonderful and insightful look into the horror genre. As a horror writer and podcaster myself, I'm always happy to hear fresh voices from the scene cast, the pale light of the full moon on the genre that is so near and dear to our dark hearts. Thank you very much for this lovely review. We've already connected through Instagram, and so Grim Thrall Podcast, the host of that podcast, will be on an episode in the near future. I also received an email with some good horror movie suggestions from Colin. Thank you, Colin, for taking the time to suggest some movies that might not have been on my radar. One of the movies he mentioned was Hard Candy, and I have that one on my list for April. That movie stuck with me. I highly recommend everyone watch it at least once. This is a weekly podcast with new episodes out every Thursday. All the research, writing, and audio is done by yours truly. This is a one-woman show, and I'm doing my very best. I have a monthly horror event at Conduit in Orlando, Florida. My next event is on February 12th. So that's going to be next Wednesday, and it's going to be based on the movies I'm covering this month. So Bride of Frankenstein, Bride of Reanimator, and Bride of Chucky. I'm really looking forward to the costume contest and seeing like a room full of undead brides. I'm working on my costume currently, and I'm really excited to like reveal it. I'm not going to say which undead bride I'm going to be, but I'll give a hint. It's like the one that you least expect. So it's pretty obvious now. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Do it because I asked you nicely and because you could be mentioned in the next episode. To a new world of gods and monsters. Until next time, goodbye.